This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In the Northern Hemisphere, we are flooded with information and entertainment from just a few media centers. Each country hears their own stories, dosed with a big helping of Trump, Putin, or Xi Jinping. But what if I told you a large part of your future depends on what is happening right now in Australia? Yes, Australia. That is where the great coral nursery of the ocean life is dying. Australia is also the country committed to shipping killer coal to Asia. Australia hopes to become the source of meat for billions of people in Asia, which could be good or bad news for the climate, depending on how it's done. And on top of all that, Australia, with its extreme weather events, may be the leading example of what we will all experience as climate disruption increases. So let's tune in to what the nightly news in Northern Lands never covers. Our guide will be the Green Radio host, Vivian Langford. Vivian and her radio mates don't just sit back and read corporate press releases, they dig. They find the right scientists and the activists, and they make important radio for the Melbourne Community Radio Station, 3CR. Vivian, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. I'm pleased to be on your show.
Well, before we get to the critical issues, Vivian, how did you find your way into green activist radio?
Well, I was interested in the effect of coal mining in New South Wales, where I live, and I went on a sort of listening tour of the Hunter Valley, and we saw a coal mine. I saw my first open-cut coal mine. It was just massive. It was like the Grand Canyon. You couldn't see the other side of it, and the person who took us there was a miner, and he was working there in the mine, but he was doing this sort of in secret, and he took some academics and people who were just interested in him. He took us to meet local people who had been active for years because it's having a huge local impact. But then I started realising the climate impact, and there's quite a big activist community here, especially starting in the Hunter Valley and in the Queensland area. And I just started realising how big the climate story was. And when I got involved with Beyond Zero Emissions, which is a Melbourne group kind of dedicated to the blueprint for the future, you know, the renewable energy and the way we could have all sorts of things. We could decouple our economy, let's say, from all that coal and gas. I got involved with them and they asked me to do their radio show. So I've been doing it for 6 years and it's been a wonderful experience because I've met so many, I'm sure you have that feeling too, you meet so many really honourable people, erudite people and just desperate people really trying to make this story get to the top of the news. You know, it just doesn't, there's a huge resistance to knowing about it, of course, but climate change is such an interesting story and there are lots of marvelous people involved in it.
Yes, I feel very lucky to be educated by some of the world's greatest experts and I'm just here to pass that on to my listeners and I think they appreciate that too. So in June 2016, I interviewed one of the world's greatest coral experts, the Australian Charlie Varan. And it was one of the saddest times, Vivian, I've ever experienced on radio. He told us the Great Barrier Reef was dying. Can you give us an update this year?
Well, I know, Charlie Varan, and it just makes those scientists absolutely miserable, as I say, desperate, because they've been telling us all of this. And unfortunately, even though this is a UNESCO heritage area, we haven't been called to account by the world community, I don't think, and our government has not put any policies that will protect it. And we had a second bleaching this year. And on top of that, a huge dieback of mangroves up in the north, in the Darwin sort of area. For your listeners up right in the north part of Australia, there's mangrove forests there, and they died back too because we're having a deep sea heat wave nearly every year, and the corals just can't take it, neither can the mangroves.
Well, surely Australians love their great reef and love the tourist dollars that it brings. What is the public reaction to coral bleaching in Australia?
Well, it's very strong, and we have huge amount of activists who are storming against it. The latest threat is the Adani Carmichael mine, which even perhaps in Canada people have heard of this Adani company, and they have a terrible environmental record. And we had a group of people who barnstormed all the main cities of Australia down the east coast with a roadshow called the Stop Adani Roadshow, and they brought out an international speaker from India, Dr. Vaishali Patel, and she told us, well, look, you know, your coal is no gift to the Indian poor. The energy or the electricity that might come from that coal will not filter down to the poorest people in India. And meanwhile, this company, Adani, is having a horrible local impact in India, environmental degradation of the greatest sort, you know, coal ships splitting open in the sea and all of the coal washing onto the coastline and fishermen being disrupted. And she said, you know, don't be persuaded by the spin that the coal companies give you that you are helping Asia by your exports of coal. It's not helping us at all. I was impressed by her. And there's many, all sorts of action at the moment. Just this last week, there's been a big banner put up by Greenpeace on one of our major bridges, but like massive banner with stopping the banks. There's banks that are bankrolling these coal mines. There's the Commonwealth Bank that's prepared to put a huge amount of money. Plus, our government is trying to put money into the Adani coal mine to the tune of about $1 billion in infrastructure for rail to the Abbott Point, and which is where the coal ships leave Australia. And our government is prepared to put $1 billion into that. And they went over to India in a delegation. The federal government and the state government all went over to India. We had photos in the paper of our prime minister with a sort of floral necklace around him, shaking hands with Adani. So we're absolutely hand in glove with them, and the citizens are totally against it. I think huge percentage, like 70% of Australians, definitely don't want this mine, but we voted in a government that's gung-ho, ready to promote it.
Right, you're totally right. You know, we've had guests here from India on Radio EcoShock who explain that 600 million people in India don't have electricity, and they're not going to get it from this coal because they're not connected to a grid. And for them, solar or other renewables are definitely the answer, not more coal. And I wonder, have people been talking about the total impact on climate change just from Australian coal?
We talk about it all the time, but it's a small group, I think, relative. If I have to be realistic, Alex, I have to constantly, you know, slap myself to remind myself that there's a lot of people who are voting in governments that just want the short-term interest, you know, the money. And as you said, there's tourist dollars there as well. There's also traditional people. There are traditional owners. I've interviewed a man called Adrian Baragaba and a woman called Marawa Johnson. They're taking Adani through the courts, you know, here, and our government has tried to change the law regarding native title, you know, and the Wangan Jagalingu people, that's their name, they're the traditional owners, and they've said to me on radio, look, we need this land, we can't have it dug up, it's like your Bible, this land is our Bible, you have to walk through the land, you have to have, like, all the chapters of the Bible have to be laid out in front of you, and that's our sacred land, can't have it just dug up, and so on, so on. And they are brave, and they are trying to take this through the court. There's a court case pending where, you know, we're hoping to get Adani to be discredited. You know, like the Indian speaker told us how they've got a terrible environment record. We've recently had a cyclone here called Cyclone Debbie up in Queensland, and massive flooding. And one of the floods caused a tailings dam. Well, it wasn't really tailings dam. I think it was near to the coal export point at Abbott Point, and it overflowed into a wetland. And you can see these aerial photographs of the whole wetland just absolutely black with the coal slurry. And they had permission to disgorge a bit of water, but they've overstepped that by 800%, and they will be taken to court for that, I think, soon. But it's such a battle against, you know, it's sort of like ants fighting off elephants. It's very small. I mean, I don't want the Canadians to think that Australians aren't fighting back, but it's not enough of us, really, that are fighting back.
And, you know, you mentioned the mangroves up in the north of Australia. Why does mangrove die-off matter?
Well, it's a buffer. You know, we're talking about sea level rise. We, you know, you as well as all your guests that I often listen to are talking about the horrific, you know, near-term scenarios of sea level rise. Well, they are coastal buffers, and they are in all those countries around Asia too. There's mangrove swamps that are being cleared at a great rate, which I'll talk a bit about later. We might talk about Malaysia, where I've seen the same thing happening. But they're a buffer to encroachments by the sea tidal developments, but they're also a nursery for all kinds of marine life, and they're a massive carbon way of carbon sequestration. We interviewed someone just a few weeks ago about blue carbon. And he was talking about, oh, the carbon, you know, the carbon sink that is involved in a mangrove forest is massive. And he's talking about in dollar terms, you know, if you wanted to pay people to sequester that carbon, the mangroves would be your very best bet.
They'd be rich. The mangroves would be rich. We should do it.
Yeah.
In a recent Radio EcoShock show, I ran a brief clip of your interview in Malaysia. Vivian Langford, why did you go there?
Well, I don't like traveling by air because of the carbon footprint, but I thought, oh, well, I haven't, you know, every 3 years I might go for a trip, and I really wanted to see Malaysia, and I absolutely loved it. The culture there is very rich, and people are so friendly, and also a lot of people speak English, so it was easy for me. But I thought, in order to sort of offset my carbon footprint, let's say, I'll interview some people and bring back some shows. So I interviewed people up in the mountains, in the logging areas. They were really interesting, but I also met some members of parliament who are doing things, and it was refreshing, really, because I don't think in Malaysia they are quite subject to the spin that we are in Australia and perhaps in America and Canada, but they did have plans for the future. You know, they did have zero carbon plans. For example, in Malacca, I spoke to the premier there, and he showed me his plan, you know, his three-stage plan. But they're starting small. They're doing energy efficiencies, and they're getting help from the Danish government. But I was impressed by that because at least it was a step on the road. They're also planning to have more coal-fired power stations. And I heard then from the not from government people, but more from activist people saying, well, what we really need is international help to help us leapfrog that stage, you know, to leapfrog the 12 new coal-fired power stations. Let's leapfrog that into renewable power, and you need international expertise and help with that. I was quite encouraged by their forward-looking attitude, and they certainly could see it clearly. They could see climate change clearly, and they could see the threat to them. But I also saw a lot of logging, and that was the tragedy.
And at that conference that you attended, you heard astounding news that energy efficiency could help us maybe avoid a total climate meltdown as the rest of the world seeks to develop. Could you tell us about that, Vivian?
Yes, well, energy efficiency depends on the source of your energy. You know, if you have renewable energy and then you make efficiencies, you don't need to build more sources of energy. You know, you really can cut it down. I interviewed people there at the hospital, and they were very impressed by the amount of money they'd saved. But then the next step would be to do it through solar power, and they would be getting themselves down to zero, you know, building by building. But I've also recently interviewed people in Melbourne about, I know they were actually in Sydney, they were French people from something called Thinkstra, and talking about the Internet of Things, and they're talking about rolling out now very cheaply monitors so that you can monitor your energy consumption, for example, on a refrigeration plant in a huge factory, or on for farmers on their gates, the sort of open gates so the cows could be rotated a bit more. And just these little monitors, very cheap now. He said previously, not cheap, you know, too expensive to roll out that, but now they're rolling this out in 62 countries, and next year it'll be, you know, 120 countries. So Thinkstra's doing a lot there. I didn't really understand the Internet of Things myself. It was a bit over my head, but he was very convincing. So I think there's developments there in the energy efficiency area that will, in fact, help countries that are looking around for solutions. So, oh, this is cheap, and this is the future, so we'll go with that. But we need to, I think rich countries need to help promote it rather than, like in Australia, just exporting more meat and coal and gas. I think that's very, really, as if we have no education at all.
Yeah, it's kind of stunning what you're talking about. Just a decade, the World Bank and national governments, a lot of them were funding development with the same infrastructure and engines used by all the developed countries to get where we are now. Everybody was going to be America or Europe or Australia all over again. And now we know that the world would be wrecked if that happens. But it sounds like there's an alternative. Will you send me that link so that I can add it to my blog for our listeners?
I will. And another one I've come across, you know, I met so many good people in Malaysia. This is what gives me heart. I met a woman called Claire Westwood, who's written a lot about food security in Asia. She's worked with poor communities to help consolidate, you know, that sort of more small-scale farm. And she talked about the second green revolution, which I hadn't really understood. She explained that now industrial agriculture, for example, is rolling out a second green revolution, which will be just as have just as much of a downside as the first Green Revolution had, and it's all to do with industrial farming, and she was very against that mega farm, as we see in Australia, these massive industrialised livestock farms. And also I met another person called Anil Netto, who's a Malaysian journalist, and he was a very sympathetic person. He talked about, he sent me his articles, and he's been, I can link that to you too, a group called Greensmiths, and they're young people, and they go into the forest, they take people into the forest, a bit like me having my first experience seeing a coal mine, but they take people into the jungle, and they see herds of elephants, and they, you know, they just appreciate and stand in wonder of what the intact jungle can look like, and they persuade people because it's the water catchment, and there's still a bit of logging there. And Anil Netto explained that, you know, we need this water catchment. We'll have droughts otherwise unless we preserve this jungle, and in our long-term interest to preserve it. But this group of youth called Greensmiths are actually a sign that the next generation, you know, it's not political for them. It's not left or right or anything. It's just, this is, you know, a thing we want to preserve for our children. So they're young people doing something there.
We are going down under for this issue of Radio EcoShock in Melbourne, Australia. Our guest is Vivian Langford, a radio activist with the program Beyond Zero on 3CR Community Radio. And we're talking about underreported issues that do affect the future of the world. And in the winter, Vivian, of 1997-98, Indonesia shot up to become the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions due to the combination of deforestation and burning peat. Now, how can Malaysia avoid going down that same route?
Well, I asked them about that too, and I had realized that year that we went to the Paris Climate Conference, that year, I think Indonesia, for 3 days running, emitted more carbon dioxide through the burning than the whole of the United States, you know, with all its industry. So that was a kind of statistic that stuck with me. And I asked the people there, and they said, actually, it's improving. They have laws in Indonesia to stop this. It's all illegal, you know, and it's often promoted by Malaysian companies and local, you know, other Asian companies who want palm oil or products from the forest, so they clear more forest by burning it. But he said to me, look, for the last 2 years, we haven't had it. Haven't had anything like this, the problem, and he's hoping that they will be getting a bit more of a grip on it, on the illegal burning. And also he said to me that there's a move there in Indonesia to re-wet the peatlands, you know, to sort of, they'd been drained, and to re-irrigate them, let's say. And he said thousands and thousands of square kilometres of land that's been drained, but to re-irrigate that will be a source of future wealth for Indonesia, but it's a massively expensive program for them. And there again, so I think where the international help, when you think of, you know, where are we going to do projects that will help the developing world avoid, or help us avoid, the worst of climate change, that would be one project. It sounded like that was a big project in need of help.
So do you think Malaysian environmentalists are allowed to speak freely or mount public protests?
No, well, I know they're not. I know that there's heavy penalties, and I know there's people in jail right now from the Bersih movement, which was, Bersih, I think, means clean up, you know, clean the politics and clean the public discourse, and there's a lot of, there'd be corruption there. But there's corruption in Australia too, so I didn't feel too happy about, you know, thinking about Malaysian corruption when I know how much is going on here. But I know it's a much tighter environment there, and the newspapers are not, there's not that wealth of newspapers or even libraries or bookshops as we have in Australia. So I would think a lot of it's internet activism, and people are very brave there. They're very brave. They were going to jail. I met the ones who were fighting the logging, and they said, look, where we put our effort in is to stand beside the indigenous people, you know, they call them Orang Asli, and those people have previously been, you know, sort of the traditional forest custodians, and they have previously been able to fend off loggers with those blowguns, you know, and that's in the past. There have been loggers killed, you know, by these Orang Asli, but now I think that the pressure of exploitation has gone ahead, and the activists are saying they are helping the Orang Asli, who get arrested, and they go to court for them, they get arrested themselves. There is a lot of pressure against, you know, there's big vested interests, and that's what I come across all the time in climate work. It's just there's always, for every solution, there's a company or a government behind the opposite. You know, let's keep it the same, let's make more money out of it short term rather than taking the long view.
And things aren't so rosy right now with Australian media. What's going on?
Oh, well, yes. Well, we've got at the moment the Fairfax Company, which is a very honourable company. We have The Age in Melbourne and the Sydney Morning Herald in Sydney. They're major papers, and I think they're mainstream, well-researched. They have used to have a huge, huge production, but they are suffering because of, I think, the transition to digital media. I've had lots of debates about it, but at the moment they're out on strike for 1 week, and so nobody's buying that paper. If it's been put out, maybe it's been put out by the company, but the journalists are all on strike because they've been sacking journalists. They sacked 120 journalists last week, and this is our, like, sort of climate news. I mean, it's been just a thread, you know, a thread among all the other news. It's one among many stories, but it's starting to come up to being the main story. And just when that's happening, all these journalists who've got expertise, they've got contacts, as you'd know, you're only as good as all your contacts, you know, and all the network of people who you can call on, they're being sacked.
All right, let's move on to cows and climate. We know that a few billion people are starting to change their diets to add more animal protein, and that could kill off many wild species, but it will really stimulate the mass production of beef in Australia. There are already more cows than humans on this planet, so let's get into that controversy. What are the negative impacts of more beef from Australia to feed the world?
Well, the negative impact, let's just stick to the climate, because people can go off on a whole riff on the dietary impact. You know, it's not good to eat so much meat. And dairy, we need to include dairy because Australia exports a huge amount of dairy products. But the methane impact of the livestock is a short-term forcer of climate change, much more impactful than carbon dioxide. And in Australia, we've mostly focused on the energy sector. We've looked at our, you know, stationary energy and the coal mines and the coal-fired power. But our land, where we have, you know, I think yesterday I did a program, and it's 26 million cows and 74 million sheep just grazing in our countryside here, and they're not grazing on the lovely green pastures you might see in Switzerland or, you know, those sort of countries. They're grazing out on very rather barren, dry northern lands, and the land just is degraded immediately. But the methane that they're emitting, you imagine 26 million cattle, the methane has a very big short-term impact on the climate. And I did a program last night, which was a rather bruising experience for me, because I had got flack from people saying I was too timid before, when I'd interviewed someone who, you know, I'd interviewed quite a few farmers, but they said, oh, you know, you should push the case a bit more. And I had been a bit cautious because it's not my real expertise. I don't know that much about it, but I think farmers are a lot under a sort of mythology because they want to make money. Of course, they have to make money. It's big business, up with mining and tourism. It's a very big business for Australia. But the kind of taking the bull by the horns, we're going to have to cut down, I think, the number of livestock we graze here for that climate impact. And it was a bruising experience because I interviewed two scientists and they were talking about different feed, you know, substituted feed and improved herd management. And I'm all on their side. I'm all ears to hear new developments. But I just think it's the actual quantity of livestock that we've got that's you cannot justify that amount of emissions.
We had Alan Savory on Radio EcoShock explaining how properly managed herds can help the local environment and help the climate. He says with proper herd management, cattle can capture carbon from the atmosphere and store it in the soil. But his technique of sort of gathering and bunching up cattle and moving them in a regular basis, I doubt that's what's really happening in northern Australia, where they're out there on gigantic tracts of land munching down anything that's alive.
That's right, and they're viewing their cattle ranch by helicopter. They're not out there feeding them seaweed supplement or rotating them, you know, in neat little bunches. But also, I think Alan Savory's had a big influence here. A lot of the farmers I've interviewed are very impressed by him, and he is a very persuasive speaker. But the person I interviewed last night, a scientist, said, look, Alan Savory has stepped back in recent times from some of his claims. and the cattle on the grasslands, they can sequester some carbon, you know, over huge grasslands. They do sequester by munching down the grass to a certain point and, you know, move on. Well, the grass underground grows, the humus is sequestering carbon. But the majority of our livestock are not out on beautiful green pastures. They're out on very dusty paddocks and then feedlots where they're finished before they're exported. But it does nothing counteract the amount of methane that they're burping out. So I think Alan Savory, although it's been very persuasive for East Coast farmers who can rotate their cattle, and I know some it's very intensive, you keep rotating them every few days, but I think we shouldn't be beguiled by that. It's a bit of a myth when you look at the actual majority of our livestock are out on very different sort of landscapes than that.
Does Australia offer farmers carbon credits, or can farmers sell carbon offsets elsewhere?
Oh, yes, they do. And we're starting to sell them into the European market so that, you know, like German drivers, for example, can offset their emissions from their cars by buying an offset on an Australian farm. But the actual government scheme for that was called the Emissions Reduction Fund. That's now drying up and we don't know what will happen next. But the carbon initiatives was mainly for cool burning. You know how we have hot burning is a bushfire, you know, in the heat of summer, but in the cool winter you can burn off, as Aboriginal people have over thousands of years. You can mosaic burn, you burn off patches, and that keeps the grass down to the point that when the heat of the summer comes on, the bushfire won't be so great. So they get credits for that, savanna burning, what they call savanna burning. They get credits also, millions of dollars have been going to farmers just to avoid clearing. So say they have a permit to clear their land and they say, all right, I'll forego that or I'll sell my permit to someone else. They can get money for that. And I think there's been quite a bit of sort of, it's a bit of a gravy train, and you can't say that it's actually, you know, a big win for the climate. It's not actually a plus for the climate. It's just avoided land clearing or avoided fires. It's not a net sequestration of carbon.
I'm having a hard time imagining how burning off grasslands, which I've been told in Africa is one of the largest sources of carbon, is going to be good to give you a credit from the government for saving carbon. I don't get it.
Well, it's just that it will be less intensive. You know, the carbon emitted from the cool fire burning is less than for the wildfire that might happen, the bushfire that might happen the next, you know, in the heat of the year. So, look, I think, but it's all this carbon accounting and carbon offsetting. It's a bit like the Vatican selling indulgences. I just think we need to seriously, you know, sequester carbon. We have to seriously revegetate, and we seriously have to stop land clearing. We had there's a film recently called Cultivating Murder, and it was about the death of a compliance officer. You know, he was a forestry compliance officer. He went around to a farm where the man was just land clearing on his own land, but clearing where he didn't have a permit to clear. And this officer went around to his property to again enforce the law, and the guy shot him. And this is such a shocking thing that this man was shot, and the film shows the trial and the kind of hard-headed attitude of a few landholders, you know, making a big money short-term, but no care in the world for the future of the land and the future of the climate. So that film was very stark, but it brought it into clear focus, the kind of interests that are at play. And that's why I felt nervous doing the agriculture program, because I think there's really big money here. And carbon credits being given to people where perhaps they shouldn't. I want some genuine, you know, a sign that we're all working together on this climate. It's like this huge existential crisis, and here we are pulling in two ways. Some people say, well, I'm going to make a short-term profit, and the others saying, please, please save our barrier reef, please save our forest, please save our land. No, not just in Australia, Malaysia too, all around. And the vested interests, some vested interests just absolutely stubbornly, you know, it's criminal, really, that sort of thing. We had to have a company here called Santos, and they're making a lot of money out of gas, and Australia is set to be now the gas exporter of the world. We're going to outbeat Saudi Arabia, you know, in our being the Saudi Arabia of gas. Apparently we had one minister in our parliament who said that we're going to be the Saudi Arabia of gas. Well, jolly good. But Santos company at their annual general meeting said last week, oh, well, actually we are working on a 4-degree warming scenario because, there's no incentive not to.
Oh, 4 degrees is utter disaster. All right, I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Australian broadcaster Vivian Langford. Now, you mentioned to me a book by Eric Toynsmer, The Carbon Farming Solution, and he was suggesting silviculture combined with cattle could be the best way to carbon capture in the tropics. How would that work?
Well, I love that book. I just discovered it. I was desperate. You know, I put so much work into that last program, and I think I overcooked it, really. I don't think it was such a good program that I did last night, but that Toynsmer really gave me some hope because he was moderate. He was not saying, you know, let's all stop eating meat or let's all change all our agriculture radically, but he did say that silviculture is the best way to have livestock grazing on legume crops. That he mentioned a thing called leucaena, and I interviewed a man on leucaena last night, and leucaena is sort of a perennial tree, but the cattle sort of eat it down to a kind of bush level. But on the either side of the paddock, you have avenues of timber trees, so it's shaded by timber trees, that's a sequestering carbon, and these perennial crops like leucaena, but there's many other varieties that the animals can eat. It's good for them. It cuts down their methane to some extent, but also the sequestration of that paddock, you just imagine a paddock with trees and perennial fodder crops, is sequestering a lot more carbon than the livestock are emitting, or they're emitting methane. So he saw lots of examples of that in his travels, and he said, to him, the chapter on livestock was the hardest one he had ever had to write because it's so contested and so complex, but he felt that was the best example and he described it very well. But I asked my guest last night, and it's not that they'd never heard of it, but I don't think it's widespread. I don't think it's been adopted. And who am I to suggest to farmers how they might run their properties? But in that book, it just really sounded very promising.
Well, when I heard from you, I looked up leucaena because I hadn't heard of it, and it's really more of a tropical tree, although it's kind of a pervasive weed tree in some parts of the world, including the southern United States. And I'm worried that how could it be prevented from taking over, like another version of the introduction of rabbits in Australia?
Yeah, that's right. I didn't even ask that question, but I know that that is a problem. Yeah, it's a weed. It even can be a weed here, but of course you have to manage it. And that's what I mean by if people were all on the same project, if we all thought climate change, we have to all work together on this and compensate people where they would have made short-term profits, but compensate them to manage. We should pay farmers to manage the land to sequester carbon, I think. Pay them to keep the forest on their property. Pay them to manage those weeds. You know, and fine them if they don't. If anyone lets, like an introduced species go wild in Australia, they must be fined immediately because that's just, we've had so many experiences in Australia of things getting out of control, including cane toads, which are on the move.
Yeah. Well, I have to remind myself, this isn't just about Australia. I mean, in Alberta, next door to where I live, they also want to be the beef exporter to China and Asia. And the American farmers feel the same way. We've got it going on in Argentina, Brazil. People are clearing away the rainforest to grow ever more cows. It just goes on. And the idea that we will create a cow planet is a bit chilling to me. It's certainly a hot topic button, as you say, especially after that movie Cowspiracy, directed by our Radio EcoShock guest Kip Anderson. So is it a real ongoing debate in Australia? Is this just something that's going on below the radar?
I think it's below the radar. Honestly, I haven't heard much about it, and I think it's because we've got such a vested interest in it. But I'm certainly hoping, I mean, the group I'm with, Beyond Zero Emissions, we published a land use report, and it is a very polarising subject. You know, some people are extreme vegans and they don't want any livestock. But there are also people making a business out of farming, and I think the middle path is, from what I heard from the people in Malaysia, Claire Westwood and Anil Netto, they're talking about like a worldwide agricultural revolution where you diversify. Farms should be diversified. They shouldn't be monocrops and run by industrial companies, you know, like Monsanto and so on. They shouldn't be. Those people have already degraded, or those companies have already had a massive impact on the environment through the first Green Revolution. Now they're trying the second Green Revolution, and we need to wise up about it and push it back. And there's a lot of pushback, I think, more from Asia, where people are starving. You know, people have been pushed off their land because of the Green Revolution. They couldn't afford all the fertilizer and the pesticide, and they have reverted. Like in Punjab, I think even in Indonesia, they've outlawed the use of certain pesticides, you know, because the natural methods of farming are actually, you know, the traditional, the time-honored ones, are actually working, and you can't go on with that sort of heavy chemical-styled agriculture. So I think maybe the pushback is coming from those countries where they have a more... You see, Australia is an immigrant country, and we brought all those cattle and sheep here from England and Europe. I suppose it's similar in America, but those countries like India and Malaysia, they've got an established agriculture, and all through Southeast Asia, they've got that village-style set up intact in a way, and they can go back to it. And so I think they're the ones leading the way. Certainly, all the people I spoke to are very much against industrial scale agriculture. I've heard in Brazil they're passing laws to stop more land clearing because the Amazon, look, it's the lungs of the world, and they're cutting back Amazon just to grow soy to feed cows. I mean, they are realizing in Brazil they shouldn't do it, but you're going to have to, you know, this business of land clearing, of traditional owners, there will be court cases, I'm sure, and there will be pushback. But I don't see it coming that much from Australia yet.
You know, you've just inspired me with an idea. In finance, they had in America the Glass-Steagall Bill, which separated the investment banking from regular banking. So when I put my money in a bank, it can't just be used by that bank to gamble on the stock market. And I think that's something that we could maybe introduce with farming. We say, well, look, farming isn't something that Wall Street should be investing in. It's something that people should run for people. So maybe we can get the agribusiness out and put the farmers back in.
Yeah, well, there'd be a lot of people who'd agree with you, and that Claire Westwood sent me an article. Your listeners might like to look it up. It's called What's at Stake, STEAK, What's at Stake, and it's run by the Global Forest Alliance. It was a marvellous report on agriculture worldwide, and initiatives like that I think would definitely help. It's a battle, you know, not yet another battle, but I think it's worth pushing. And also, what I got the impression from last night talking to the people, this is a kind of a low-hanging fruit. We can't stop the Arctic permafrost melting. We can't stop, just at the moment in Antarctica, just south of here, we've got a part of an ice shelf absolutely about to carve off as an iceberg, massive iceberg. In one article I read, 300,000 times bigger than the iceberg that sank the Titanic. You know, we can't imagine things as big as this, but we can't stop that. These are things we cannot stop in climate change. In your program, you know, honestly interviews people all the time telling news like that that we can hardly take in. But what we can take in, couldn't we do something about these animals right in front of us, and couldn't we look at the agriculture we've had before, you know, try time on it and traditional methods that have worked before to feed people and to feed people locally. You know, it's within our mental grasp. It's part of something that we sort of can deal with rather than these bigger issues. I just feel climate change is so devastating when you think of that. Those bigger things, we can't deal with them, but let's deal with the things we can deal with.
Tell us about your radio show, Beyond Zero. What do you cover and how do you manage to keep it going?
Well, I never have any lack of people to interview, and it's based on Beyond Zero Emissions is a think tank, and it's a research group, and we publish reports, so they're kind of like blueprints, and so I use them as a basis. I mean, the topics of them as a basis, and I try to update them all the time by, you know, getting more information. For example, you know, the latest thinking on each aspect, like high-speed rail or insulation in housing and buildings or energy efficiency, any of those topics, I use that as my guideline. And my other guideline is it's part of 3CR, which I know your program is also on 3CR, so, you know, radical and progressive alternative radio, and alternative in the sense that we can interview people that are not your mainstream voices, who are not part of the co-opted, you know, corporate language that's part of the mainstream media. And I feel that we can go and interview lots of different people to inspire the audience. And part of the work it's evolved to be is that I'm interviewing community activists and to inspire people. And we started interviewing psychologists and philosophers, because really it's the thing about getting your head around climate change, not burying your head in the sand, trying to, in a limited way, take action. And each one of us is limited, but, you know, we have to take action. And at the Adani Roadshow, there was a comedian there, and I thought she said something very true, even though it was a joke. But she said, oh, well, you know, imagine, I think this whole earth, it's a kind of rental property. Let's think of it like a rental property, and God comes down to check the rental property, and he or she looks around and says, gosh, what have you done to it? Look at these big holes, these big black holes in the coal mines. We can see them from space. And look at this coral reef, my coral reef all bleached. What have you done to it? And then she said, well, you won't get your bond back. So I sort of, we're sort of in that state. We're like these naughty children who are just making hay while the sun shines. But we know with the bigger issue of climate change, we have to bring some more voices into the stream of thinking. That's what I feel. Beyond Zero is my foundation stone, but it's all these other voices like psychologists and thinkers and actors and comedians and all sorts of people who are trying to help us face it.
How do people find Beyond Zero Emissions, the group, and then how do they find the radio program?
You just Google that name, Beyond Zero Emissions. And the podcasts are all there. If you look under media, you just go down, there's podcasts. And the ones I've done are in the community radio. And there's just an absolute great wealth of people there speaking. I can't say I always do really professional radio. You know, we have hitches and sometimes I get lost in my questions and I'm a bit over, I talk too much maybe, or I don't know. I just feel that it's part, I just have to do what I can. I do my very best. I research it as well as I can. But the podcasts are, they're wonderful. They're not slick. You know, I ask my adult children to listen to them and they don't want to listen to them and they think, oh, it's mum, you know, climate panic. They just joke about me because I think they just don't want to see what I'm doing. But also, I think the kind of podcasts they listen to are a lot more palatable and smooth and easy and quirky. But I just do this straight on, you know, interviews of people telling what they can. You know, that's the path I'm on at the moment. So
yeah, but that's radio, you know. I mean, radio, live radio is like that. And people have told me for years that radio is just going to evaporate and be replaced by everything internet. And it hasn't. And I don't think it will. Do you think radio can still help us make a better society or help us save a troubled planet?
Oh, definitely. Well, definitely with podcasts. You know, the podcasts, people can plug them in. You know, I listen to yours, for example, when I walk the dog or I go to the park. I just listen to your Eco Shock as I'm walking. So that's a very convenient way of radio. And I went to a film about Syria and it was called Radio Kobani and it was just about the liberation city, and they just went around and interviewed people and gave heart. You saw, you know, from the absolute devastated, crushed city, Kobani, but this little radio station, just young women, they were interviewing people and putting music out, and it was giving people heart. And I went to Timor a few years ago and I have an interest in East Timor and our radio 3CR, which, you know, the station 3CR, they had sent people up there to teach radio, to teach how to make radio. And I went and talked to one of the radio hosts there. There was this tiny little woman, Senora Dolce. She was up in this place called Baucau. And I said to her, what's your program? And she said, oh, it's talkback. We do talkback. I said, who do you talk back with? She said, with farmers. Because I get farmers to ring in. And she said, not from the roads are so bad here and we have rains, you know, wipe away the whole road and bridges and no one can get anywhere. So the farmers talk through me on radio to each other. And I said, what do they talk about? And they sort of think, oh, my cow is sick. What can I do about it? And then someone else will ring her program and give some advice about the cow. I thought, what a fabulous use of radio. Look at that.
Yes, that's tremendous. And I would like to encourage some of my listeners in the United States or in other countries to think about doing radio themselves, because With the low-power FM stations, it's a lot easier to get a permit, and you can do a volunteer setup. You don't even have to do it 24 hours a day. You could be on for 2 hours a day if you want to. And I think there's just a lot of opportunity for people to go ahead and get the word out there, because the mainstream media is just so bad, so awful. You know, I've been watching television news. I want to tell you, here in Canada, we've had a series of floods both in the west and in the east that are unusual. Thousands of evacuations, roads washed out, you have to boil your water, all this thing is going on. So I watch these long reports on television, and never is the word global warming mentioned or extreme weather events. It's as though there's no awareness that scientists have already told us years ago that this was going to happen. Now it's happening, and still people aren't told what the ultimate causes of it are.
And the ultimate, and the solutions. You know, as I said, there's low-hanging fruit solutions. You could reduce the, you could change agricultural practice, you could stop using fossil fuels. These are low-hanging fruits. It's not rocket science. But people don't spell out the solutions. They think, oh, it's some huge, massive death of capitalism solution. But it's not necessarily that. It's decoupling. Naomi Klein says it very well, you know, decouple the economy from the fossil fuel and the methane and all that. Yeah, but it's not even mentioning the word climate change. They don't even mention the word. And that's why I'm so worried about all these journalists being out on strike, because they're the journalists who are starting to be free about using climate change. Not that they talk about solutions either, most of the journalists, but, you know, it's just terrible. I think it's corporate media. It's a corporate thing. That's why alternative radio, like community radio, is free. You do have this freedom, and a wonderful freedom. I don't think a lot of the stations really use it well enough. I sometimes go to, you know, country places and listen to the local radio, and it's mostly just music or chit-chat or fluff. You know, it's comforting. It's nice chit-chat, local stuff. But what about these interesting, fascinating, these people you interview and people I interview, they're just so wonderful to hear, you know, and I don't know why more communities don't sort of get involved. Australia's very conservative, though. It's a very conservative country, so.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, there's also some really inspiring activism. I remember seeing a march that happened in Melbourne that I went, wow, you know, there are a lot of Australians who get this. It was a climate march.
It is, but why doesn't our culture have more voices like this? Why hasn't this livestock methane story been, you know, discussed robustly, you know, more? I don't know. I keep coming across speakers, and I keep going to meetings too with my recorder, audio recorder, and there's no one else there. There's no other media there, and so I record the session or the rally or the speaker. I think, gosh, how come it's just me? There should be other media here, but they're not.
The other thing that shocks me is I know Australia went through some deadly fires, very, very shocking fires, and we had some bad fires here, not as bad as that. You have these major events where climate change is a factor. We won't say it's all of it, but it's some of it. Things are getting hotter and the fire season is longer and so on. And yet even the people who have been burned out of their homes or flooded out of their homes or had great extreme weather events don't seem to be ready yet to start talking about what we're talking about in our radio shows.
Yes, well, I'm going to do a show this week on flood damage. We've just had floods from the cyclone Debbie, and I will interview people about their reactions, but I won't press climate change on them. Just as those Malaysian people I spoke about, they didn't press, you know, some ideological agenda on those forest people. They just helped them protect their forests. And I would think I could interview people who are suffering the results, but it's that bigger frame of thinking that city people who have the leisure to think and who have the money to, you know, my house hasn't been blown away by a cyclone ever. You know, I haven't had to repair my roof or do anything like that. And I think the city people should really be the ones who are involved in that bigger agenda of what's causing it. Also, the other thing that frames people's mind is the media. That's why I say all this local country media, you won't get them mentioning climate change either. And the solutions, they won't voice it. And so our mainstream media, like the Cyclone Debbie, it was in or the fires, you know, they're just in the news for a week or so, and it's a hard luck story and a story of community resilience, and everyone feels good about the mop up. But then we just go back to the next one. So, I mean, some climate activists used to say to me, what we need is a really big event. You know, like, but we've had a Hurricane Sandy in New York, you know, a whole massive city like that flooded. I mean, I don't believe in that theory that we need a big event. I think we need to bring the big events that are already happening, like that iceberg carving off and the side of Antarctica. Those stories need to be brought more to the front of mind, you know, and coupled with a message that you can do something, that we can do something, not about the iceberg, but we can do something about the forces, the short-term forcing of methane, for example, or the long-term forcing of carbon dioxide. I just feel that message that I don't get depressed about climate change. I just get depressed about the media and the mental straitjacket people are kept in. You know, I like the idea of education, enlightenment, just opening people's minds. It should be possible to work together on solutions.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
It seems, I know in North America, that as the media is floundering with the arrival of the internet and their advertising dollars, that some of the people who are making a lot of money out of fossil fuels or out of mining, as it is in Australia, have the money to buy up these newspapers and television stations. It's happening in the United States right now, where the Tribune Company may be bought by this very right-wing group called the Sinclair Group. I know they won't cover climate change once they buy it. And it seems you have the same problem in Australia. I don't know what we're going to do about that. Perhaps only community radio and podcasts and YouTube videos are going to be the way that this goes viral enough that enough people are kept conscious that, hey, there's a big picture here. I'm really scared for my grandchild. I hate to pass on what we're doing to him.
No, I think he'll be part of the fight. He'll just have to be part of it. It's definitely a intergenerational thing. We're passing it on. And I think the alternative sources of media are, you know, look, there's revolutions in everything. When I talked to that fellow from Thinkstra, I could hardly get my mind around what he was telling me, this Internet of Things. And he was telling me how just last year it all would have been too expensive, but just now they've pushing it forward. So these little monitors monitoring all the energy. So that would mean we don't have to build more coal-fired power, certainly, but even we'll need less power for more energy use. We'll have more energy use, but we'll have less need for power using the efficiencies. So that's one thing. The young people I told you about in the Malaysian forest taking people in, they're thinking of their grandchildren too. They said, one of the things they said is, we would want to be able to bring people here even when we're old, or in the future we'd like this place to be here for the future. I think it's far more distant than your grandchild or his grandchild. You know, it's we've got to think very much longer term than we are doing now. And we're talking about a cultural shift. I mean, people in the Renaissance didn't say, oh, we'd better get a new newspaper, we'd better get a radio station, or we'd better get some scribes, you know, churning out these books. No one knows when they're in the middle of a cultural shift how it's going to work out. It's like in the Blitz of London, no one knew that they were going to win the war, or in the U-boats, you know, in the wartime. I often think of that wartime analogy. Those people didn't know how it would turn out, and we don't know how it's going to turn out either, but we're doing our best. And I think this thing of bringing the best people, like you're doing all the time, you bring people to the air that no one else was bringing to the air. I've never heard of those people before, or their work, and you go and read their book, or you follow up, you know. You had Amitav Ghosh, you know, and he said to you, you know, I always listen to your program, Alex. Well, what a great compliment. You know, someone who's a major writer and who himself has admitted that our culture can hardly deal with climate change. No novelists are really dealing with it. And he himself has written a climate change book, which doesn't, I don't think, adequately even really deal with it. But he's grappling with the problem. And when people like that and people like us, I think we've just got to keep trying that. And who knows how it'll flip. You never know when just around the corner there's a big shift. Could be in agriculture, could be, certainly I think it's going to be Adani, like the coal mines have got to close. It's got to happen. Won't save the Barrier Reef though.
You know, You don't know it, but you've just given me a real gift. I think when you talked about the people in the Blitz in London being bombed, not knowing how it was going to turn out, but it did turn out better for them that they experienced victory eventually, could be where we are right now. And we had Noam Chomsky, a speech by him on the program recently where he said, well, we're going over the precipice. And a listener who follows the show said, well, we're already over that precipice. And another listener chimed in on Facebook and said, well, then we're going to have to learn to fly. And I think we're going to have to leave that. I really appreciate talking with you. We've been talking with the Green Radio host down under, Vivian Langford from 3CR Community Radio and Beyond Zero Emissions. You can find past shows on their website at www.3cr.org.au/beyondzero or just Google Beyond Zero Emissions. You can listen right online or download the programs for free. And I'll put links to my own show, to all of that, at ecoshock.org. Vivian, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our emissions are increasing. There's no question about it. They're increasing at about 2% per year. Last year, it was about 3% per year. And that 1% is a gigantic amount of carbon gone into the atmosphere. So we're chugging away towards a climate catastrophe, really. And I'm not just making that up. That's what the scientists that we talk to are saying. Whether we can avoid it or not will depend on a mass change in consciousness around the world. Canada, Australia, the UK, Europe, Brazil, and every country who can is promising to develop more fossil fuel resources. We're investing billions, possibly trillions of dollars and pounds into more mega coal mines, more fracked gas and liquid natural gas plants, bigger tar sands and shale oil projects. Humans seem intent on fossil suicide. Climate. Shall we wait for the revolution?
We have to start from where we are. And if we were to demand the shutdown of the capitalist system and a transformation of human consciousness before we can do any of this, we're not going to get it done. Now, in my last book, I was talking about a sort of this massive sweeping program of global democratization and all the rest of it, and I haven't gone back on that. I still believe it's absolutely necessary and that we need to have huge efforts to restrain the system of runaway global capitalism and all the rest of it. But we have 24 years. In fact, we have much less than 24 years. We have 2 or 3 years to turn this around and get carbon emissions falling on the ski jump trajectory. And that means we can't wait on those other proposals. Yes, they are necessary, and yes, we must keep them in our mind as our long-term aims. But if they have to come first, we're finished. There's going to be nothing we can do in the available time. So we have to make use of a system which can mobilize investment, which can mobilize resources. And for all its manifest faults, the current system can do that. And what I've tried to do in my book is to look at how we can use the existing system rather than the idealized system which we would prefer to replace that system with. And my belief is that I've shown that with that system it can be done because you can appeal to the grubby motives that many politicians and corporations have, just as much as you appeal to the moral imperative which we know that we must pursue. And even within this profoundly corrupt system that we have, we can create the political pressure to make these changes inexorable. I mean, the effort that I've made throughout all this is to show that these measures are compatible with the survival of industrial civilization. And that's not because I'm a particular fan of industrial civilization, but it's because I know that if I stand up and say, let's return to an agricultural society, for example, it's pure self-indulgence. Because whether or not I believe that's a good idea, the great majority of people do not. And we have to go with what the majority of people see as being their quality of life and the sustaining of that quality of life. And that means we've got to find ways of accommodating it as much as possible, which are compatible with that 90% cut. That's what I've tried to do. I'm not saying abandon the ideals which you've articulated, but I'm saying don't wait for them to be met first.
George Monbiot speaking in Vancouver on November the 15th, 2006.
You can help Radio EcoShock keep going. Make a donation at our website, ecoshock.org.